Everybody, this is William Del Pilar, and this is the Red, White, and Rude podcast, where pop culture and politics intersect. Today, we dive into a galaxy far, far away and explore the recent cosmic crash of the Acolyte. Yes, folks, it seems that when you go woke, you might go broke. At least that's a lesson Disney learned as they pulled the plug on an ambitious $22.5 million per episode Star Wars spinoff after just one season. And in gaming news, in a move that's sure to shock absolutely no one, Kotaku has once again proven its commitment to journalistic excellence by appointing a new editor-in-chief with a stellar background in check notes, music. But wait, there's more. Our new literary maestro comes with a bonus feature, a rich history of making unabashedly racist comments about white people on social media. Because nothing says gaming expertise quite like a deep-seated disdain for a significant portion of your audience, right? Bravo, Kotaku. You've truly outdone yourselves this time. And speaking of things that are a bit off, let's chat about Alan Wake 2, a game that seems to have taken a hit for its own slightly woke elements and a misunderstanding of how exclusivity works and why. It turns out that while players are battling dark forces, the game itself is grappling with its own identity crisis, with a new protagonist who occasionally laments about another white asshole deciding her fate. It's as if the writers couldn't resist throwing in a cheeky nod to the cultural climate. Who knew that navigating a supernatural horror story would come with a side of social commentary? Maybe next time, Alan should stick to fighting shadow monsters instead of societal expectations. After all, it's hard to save the world when you're busy checking all the right boxes. Hello, everybody. Once again, this is William Del Pilar, and welcome to my latest episode into pop culture. Let's just get right into it. Let's start it off with Star Wars, The Acolyte. Going woke led to going broke, and Disney's wallet is feeling the force. I crack myself up. I know it. All right. So, The Acolyte was an ambitious, high-budget Star Wars series. It was set in the High Republic era with a budget of $180 million. Wow. I mean, that's just incredible. Let me share my screen here so y'all can see some wonderful renditions of it. There it is, The Acolyte. It's a cool little logo, you know. So that The $180 million budget translates to about $22.5 million per episode. And it was canceled after one season. Wow. All righty. That's a wonderful image. I love that. That's from their X account. You know, that I got that from the X account as well. And finally, that was the logo going in. So, let me end this share. It was set in the High Republic era, which is set about 500 BBY. Now, not being the Star Wars nerd that most kids are today, I had to look that up. Just so the audience knows, I stood in line to see the first Star Wars when it came out. I stood in line to see the second Star Wars and the third Star Wars. And in fact, that was the era you see now when they talk about these shows. You see them show these long lines of people. I was in one of those lines. It was great. You're all excited to go see it. But anyway, that was my extent of Star Wars. I collected the comic for a while. Who knows what the first issue's worth? I used to have that. But the BBY stands for Before the Battle of Yavin. So it's set from 500 BBY to 100 BBY. Now, people of my era going, what the hell is a Yavin? In essence, That is the standard set where Luke Skywalker destroys the first Death Star, ergo the first Star Wars movie. It's not the first one now in the series itself, but it was the first actual Star Wars movie. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. Those three movies are the only ones that really matter. Everything else is just a get-rich-money scheme. I don't care what George Lucas talks about. Those prequels were terrible. I actually, because I love Star Wars so much and was feeling nostalgic when the first prequel movie came out, I went out to the theater to see it with the missus. One of the few times I've ever started to fall asleep, doze off at a movie. True story. So anyway, The Acolyte is set around 132 BBY, meaning about 132 years before Luke Skywalker discovers the Force and does the Death Star a fatal blow. Now, this movie, the problem with this, here, I'm going to tell you about the problem with this movie, this series, the creator's vision and the marketing of it. It was done by Leslie Headland, and her goal was to make the gayest Star Wars entry. Now, I'm conservative, grew up in a fundamentalist family. I had issues with my mother growing up. I had a couple of friends. Now, when I grew up being gay, most people were still in the closet. So I had a couple of friends who were in the closet, you know, so I obviously rebelled against my mother's ways. But when it comes to heterosexual PDA or that type of stuff, it's like, I don't need to see all of that. Keep it in the bedroom. Keep it to yourself. We get it. Same thing with gay. Keep it in the closet. Well, not in the closet, but keep it to yourself. No different than heterosexual. She wanted to make it the gayest Star Wars entry. She wanted to throw it in your face. People like us, we don't care, but we don't like anything shoved down our throats. And that goes with my issue with some fundamentalists, you know, and God bless those people. I love those people too. So the whole point was to have a heavy emphasis on the LGBTQ plus ABC, XYZ, yada, yada, yada. I mock that because it seems like they keep tossing letter after letter after letter to the point gays of my era are sick of it because they feel that everything they fought for and they gained is being usurped by transgenders and others. Here's the irony. We moved to the South from Panama. My dad was in the military. So to Fayetteville, North Carolina, or Vietnam, as we call it. And blacks of my era will tell me that gays have usurped the civil rights. And I'm like, what do you expect? It's human nature. You know, what works for what's good for the goose is good for the gander is how another group will see it. And eventually everybody's going to use the civil rights except for whitey. You know, they're the only ones not allowed to use it. You know, so I'm not shocked at how this has gone. But it was very controversial, some of the narrative choices, the planet run by a lesbian community with a black woman as a queen. It was like just in your face. Now, again, there's nothing wrong with this when it's a good movie or a good show. Nobody cares. You just care about great character development, great acting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there were scenes discussing pronouns that was defended as obviously a joke. Well, that's not how it was taken. And there was an attempt to break down the Jedi as a concept and kind of revise the history and the narrative of being a Jedi. You know, now there was complaints about the casting choices, a non-binary in the lead role, a gay and a lesbian in prominent roles. There was a franchise's first transgender actress. Now, nobody cares, again. But when you shove it down people's throats and you call everybody bigoted before you even start your marketing in terms of trying to stave off people who will complain about it, say, oh, you're just bigoted. People who complain are going to be bigoted or they're racist. You know, Amazon started that with the Rings of Power, I believe. They knew what was coming because they knew they were creating a woke show. And the Rings of Power probably won't last past season two based off the cost and the fact the numbers drastically dropped of who watched it. And I think they're just putting a thumb in everybody's eye or giving everybody the finger by doing the season two. The numbers are probably not there and they won't give out the numbers. I think they didn't state how long it took to reach a certain amount of million of minutes. And they were doing that with every other show because they were reaching them quickly. You know. But anyway, enough about the Rings of Power. But it was the same concept here. Before the marketing even began, they were trying to stave off any negative reaction by claiming you're a bigot or you're racist. You know, and they, again, they shoved all this down your throat as if this is what's going to make the make it all great. No, a great story will make it great. Great writing, great acting. We got none of that. Well, I'm not going to talk about the acting, but we got no great writing. Terribly produced, terrible storylines. The marketing approach, again, emphasizes inclusive themes shoved down our throats. There were even comments made about R2-D2 possibly being lesbian. I'm like, what? They were unconcerned about the potential backlash. You know, they just felt because it's Star Wars is going to be a hit and they will be able to ride that wave. The problem is every Star Wars movie since the prequels have been a money, not money losers. Let me correct myself. They've earned less and less money. Okay, Amanda Stenberg, she was the non-binary in the lead role, dismissed woke concerns. Okay, what about it? Was her comment. Quote, okay, what about it? Unquote. Headland, those engaging in bigotry are not considered fans. You see, this is was their response, is to double down. Instead of going, well, maybe we shouldn't have focused on that as much as focusing on a great story. You know, you guys are right. We're going to be who we are, but we're going to make sure the storyline comes first and not having a show and making a woke commentary out of it. You know? And there was also a lack of concern for traditional fan expectations. Look, they focused on pushing boundaries over established lore, meaning they cared more about being woke, about being gay, about being transgender, about shoving all that down the Star Wars fans' throats instead of creating great stories out of the established lore. Part of the backlash, some viewers accuse the show of being racist and bigoted. And I can see that. When you're shoving something down somebody's throat, that's what you're going to get. Viewership, reception, and obviously the controversy. Look, the two-episode premiere, 488 million minutes watched. The finale had 335 million minutes watched, about a 31.4% decrease from the premiere. In essence, the show was trending the wrong way. You want to show the trend up as reviews come in, as people pick up, wow, it's a great show. You got to watch it. Instead, it was trending downward. By episode 4, it was estimated only 1.9 million viewers per episode was moving forward. You can't have a show that costs $22.5 million per episode with a viewership of 1.9 million. Disney Plus, they've got, that's a great question. I'm not sure. Let me check this out real quick. I will be right back. All right, I found it. Disney has 154 million global subscribers. And that number's dropped from last year. That was in the first quarter of 2024. So what was it? 154 million global subscribers. They were only getting 1.9 million viewers per episode. It lost 75% of Star Wars fans compared to The Mandalorian, which I believe is also canceled or on permanent hiatus. Now, real quick, about that 154 million global subscribers, I'd say a good anywhere from 10 to 25% of them are forced subscribers. So I subscribe to Hulu because I like having access to various cable channels that I used to have when I was on cable. And I was forced at an extra $5 a month. I was told, you now have ESPN Plus and Disney Plus, but we're charging you an extra like $5.99, $4.99, or $5.99 a month. This was a year or two ago. You know, Disney recently, maybe a year ago, they went to where they got their adult themed movies, say, think Deadpool. So there's a different way to subscribe to that, the access that I haven't even bothered. You know, it's just too woke for me, you know. So comparison, getting back to the Acolyte, comparison to other Star Wars series, second worst premiere ratings of any Disney Star Wars series. Lower viewership than Ahsoka, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and the Book of Boba Fett. It only slightly outperformed Andor in initial viewership. Again, $22.5 million per episode, people. Rotten Tomatoes, 78% critic score. Woohoo! It's riding a high wave amongst critics who believe if it's woke, I loves it. 27% audience score. That's people like me and like you. 78% by the woke media, 27% by people they're shoving their woke agenda down. We didn't like it. We didn't want it. And it's since been canceled. IMDb, 4.1 out of 10 with 46% of reviews at 1 of 10. Wow. Wow. Mixed review from critics, unlike the well-received Andor. The audience rating dropped to 14% on review aggregators. Look, nobody wants woke trash shoved down their throats. And this was as woke as you could get. So, I originally said it was a $180 million budget. I read elsewhere that, where was it? That it was a $200 million budget. So the point is $180, $200 million budget. Now, you have to, maybe that $200 million came because there's a $50 to $100 million more spent on promotions. So the cost nearly double that of Ahsoka, $187 million versus $100 million. So here's the bottom line. Between you're talking about $200 million approximately when you count in the marketing for it. So Ahsoka's viewership was nearly double that of The Acolyte. They had big plans for The Acolyte, too. I mean, this was going to be their woke flagship show that Disney was going to use to help indoctrinate. And that's what Disney's been doing the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And their movies have shown. The movies that aren't woke, Deadpool and Wolverine, and there's the latest In and Out. I can't remember the latest animations. It's not really woke. They're all shattering records. When you put out a good product, people will come to see it. So the numbers I gave you, I have to put a caveat that there's no standardized reporting. These aren't speculative as much as there's really, like with cable or with network TV, you had Nielsen, you had a straightforward formula. There's also some self-reported data with the third-party measurements. Let's give you an analogy. I used to get frustrated because when people used to come advertise on my website, my website was ranked in the top 2,000 in the world. This was before I sold it in 2006. My partner and I, we sold it. Some of the big media who would use third parties, they'd always say, well, this is what we got. I'm like, I'm sending you the actual logs. This is what your guys' performance was on our website. This is what we're going by. You don't need the third party. Here's the actual log data. I was like, you ain't going to screw us out of any money. And so there's always issues in terms of crunching some of these numbers down. So again, viewers are put off by the show's attempt to break down the Jedi as a concept, complaints about the departure from the traditional Star Wars themes. Again, accusations of being too woke and pushing an agenda. The general downward, as I mentioned earlier, there was a general downward trend in viewership and interest in the franchise. So you typically need 1+ billion minutes watched per season. Now, that's a typical show. These Disney shows, when you're talking budgets of 22, 25 million, think She-Hulk 2, you have to have your, the 1+ billion is really probably, I'm speculating, but anywhere from 1.5 to 2 billion minutes needed. Because you're talking some serious change being put into these shows. So it failed to meet this benchmark. I think it was probably close to 1 billion, maybe even surpassed it. But with the downward trend in streaming minutes and the cost of the show, it probably needed 1.5 to 2 billion. And again, I'm speculating here, but I'm a stats guy. I understand how all this works. The key metric here, it was a lack of sustained viewer engagement. Again, it was trending down. Less people were watching it as the season went. Obviously, the reasons for cancellation was poor viewership relative to high production costs, negative audience reception, narrative and character issues. There were pacing problems with the storylines, inconsistent character portrayals, and then it was an underwhelming depiction of the High Republic Jedi. You know, Star Wars lore was being ignored and thrown under the bus for a woke agenda. I put it in my notes as misalignment with established Star Wars lore and fan expectations. That's Dell's writing style. There's also behind-the-scenes drama. Rumor circulated the studio was planning a second season until recently. And even though they had a hope for it to continue, they were talking more woke storylines, more woke agenda. The cancellation did surprise some of the actors and some of the people surrounding the show, with one actor or one cast member like, really? They canceled it? So they were probably told by their agent, oh, man, this is a gig we're going to have for a while here, people. There were indications of internal conflicts at Lucasfilm Disney as well. The show was subject to an extensive notes process. Again, viewership collapse had massive concerns there internally. And the final nail in the coffin, despite everything I said, is what cancels every show in Hollywood. Poor viewership. You know, so Andor's viewership, now that seemed to have steadily climbed as the season went on, and that's why it got renewed. And there was also the mixed reviews for The Acolyte. There really wasn't mixed reviews. So, some of the critics did not like it, but overall, the critics loved it. They loved it because it was woke. The people hated it. And we, the people, now have access to giving our own reviews, whether it's through blogs, whether it's through Rotten Tomato Meter, whether it's through IMDb. The viewers now can give their own reviews. And when it comes to that type of stuff, it's like Amazon.com. It's like Amazon. You kind of like go to the viewers' reviews, not what somebody who's paid or the top 10 of this or that. You go to what the viewers are actually saying. Same thing here. So one of the complaints, and I feel for the actual fans who believe in Star Wars, love the lore, etc., is when you have a series canceled and it leaves you with certain cliffhangers unresolved. God, I hate that. So I do feel for the people. Now, how do we know it was canceled? Merchandise. The removal of the Acolyte merchandise from the Disney store. All merchandise related to the Acolyte disappeared from the official Disney store. You got links to Acolyte products at 404 errors. Searches for the Acolyte at the store returned with no results. And the removal predated the show's cancellation, which occurred. The show's cancellation was announced on August 19th. And looking for some of the merchandise between July 29th and August 6th, you're going to find it. You know, you don't take merchandise off a store if it's not going to be canceled. Now, some of the merchandise has reappeared at the Disney store, and there are certain products are now back on stock and can be purchased at the official Star Wars store as well. Oh, man. Let's see. What else? Okay, so before I close this out, I wanted to compare it to another series that has a diverse cast, that is led by a woman in a male-dominated setting. And obviously, I'm talking about House of the Dragon. Both are high-budget fantasy series, diverse cast, and have different outcomes. Viewership, critical reception, and continuation differences are in all of them. Production costs and franchise performance is high. The franchise performance being exact opposites here. The House of the Dragon is just flying high where the Acolyte has bombed. House of the Dragon is well-received despite the diverse casting. Translation, we don't care about that as long as it's a good storyline. Again, House of the Dragon, very diverse. They're focused more on a great storyline. The Acolyte is focused more on shoving wokeness and pushing an agenda. I'm repeating myself a bit, but just to show you the differences, the Acolyte's marketing campaign, all it focused on was diversity, inclusion, wokeness, shoving it down our throats. They prioritized social messaging over storytelling. The House of the Dragon was perceived as integrating diversity organically into the narrative. That's how you break barriers down. You just organically put it. It's how life moves on. Each generation becomes more open and more welcoming as we leave the past behind. Instead, it's going the opposite. We're getting more and more wokeness, more and more racism amongst minorities. Yo soy Latino. I'm Latino. I have seen it with my people firsthand. So where it's organically done is part of us moving forward as humans, as Americans. Instead, it's purposely shoved. So what I'm trying to say is they're saying all white bad, all color good. When the reality is you have various cultures coming together as Americans as each generation moves forward. That's organic. That's the true melting pot. That's how the House of the Dragon is moving forward. Whereas the Acolyte is trying to replace one culture with another and saying, if you don't like it, you're racist. And that's why the Acolyte failed and the House of the Dragon is not and is an uber success. So what's the implication for the Star Wars franchise? Well, they have to have a content strategy reassessment. Questions about leadership and decision-making have to take place at Lucasfilm / Disney. It's not at the moment, but it's going to have to. What Disney needs to learn is what I just said about House of the Dragon. It's the importance of aligning the creative vision with audience expectations, meaning the creating vision or the creators of these shows must give the audience what they want and what they expect. A Star Wars story based off Star Wars lore. We don't care about diversity in the sense of bring it on. Give us a great story. The first diverse scene that is, I mean, it's diverse from the get-go, the very first Star Wars movie. But then the famous Star Wars bar scene. I mean, they're all aliens there. You know, the white lead is like the minority in that scene alone. Nobody cares when it's a fun storyline. Then there's also creating fresh narratives in beloved franchises. And that's tough. You know, it's when I saw J.J. Abrams' first foray into Star Wars, I went to the theater to see that with the family reunion. We all went. I left there thinking, wow, all he did was redo Star Wars, the original one. And just, it's kind of like, that's all he did was redo that movie. J.J. Abrams has a bad habit of doing that. He did that with Star Trek, one of the most overrated directors and creative minds in Hollywood. But it's tough. I mean, every storyline has been done, you know, so it's a matter of recreating them and making them different. So in conclusion, the Acolyte's cancellation highlights the risk of prioritizing ideological messaging over audience engagement and franchise consistency. This failure, it raises questions about future of Star Wars and the handling of the diversity in mainstream franchises, meaning don't shove it down our throat, just give it to us organically. This underscores the need for balanced approach in storytelling and respecting both diversity and established franchise elements. And just because you slap a Star Wars logo on it doesn't mean it's going to be a success. So let me know in the comments what you think of my take of this, but that's kind of how I view all of this. So let's move on. Leveling Up Diversity, Kotaku's new anti-white editor-in-chief, hits all the right demographic notes. But can he even press start? I love my little witty intros. Some people are like, huh, what's he talking about? You know, he hits all the demographic notes, meaning he checks off all the check marks of DEI. But can he even press start, meaning does he know how to play games? So, Kotaku hired Austin Williams, a young, good-looking, dresses sharp as hell black man, as their new editor-in-chief. And Kotaku is, I'm not going to say it's popular because it's not, but it's a well-known digital media outlet focused on gaming news and culture. It's supposed to be focused on gaming news. I threw the culture in there because it's a woke company. The appointment was made by the parent company, GO Media, in late July or early August. So very recent. He replaces Jen Glennon, who resigned from Kotaku because ownership at GO Media, they wanted to deprioritize news and culture for game guys. In essence, we got to make money, people. We got to make money. They have to start figuring out how to make money. Kotaku isn't really a gaming site, but a woke activist site promoting DEI and attacking gamers who simply want great games versus wokeness. So, to people my age who don't necessarily keep up with everything like I do culturally, let me find it here. This is Sir Austin Williams. Sir, the way he looks and dresses, I just want to say Sir Austin Williams. Good looking man. You know, I tell you this, growing up in the South and having a lot of black relatives, I've seen my fellow black friends, they dress sharply. I mean, he's a very sharp dressed man. They can pull the bow tie off. Most white people look kind of goofy, but it's a good looking brother there. You know, there's a picture of him more hip clothing. And there is Kotaku's logo. So, he is serving as the editor-in-chief, and he's going to be leading the editorial direction of the gaming news site. And he's going to maintain his role as a professor of media studies alongside his new position at Kotaku. My understanding is he teaches at a community college. Now, the reason I sat there and said... he hits all the right demographic notes is because, as I said with my intro, he's primarily known for music journalism and academia rather than gaming journalism. He worked at Complex Networks, BuzzFeed, BET Digital, and Vibe Magazine. All of those are uber woke organizations or outlets. So the question becomes, was he a DEI hire? Yes, he was. Why do I say this? Geo Media called Williams' appointment a milestone as Kotaku's first African-American editor-in-chief. They were looking for skin color, not qualifications, as his music background shows, and as their woke anti-white rhetoric shows, and I'm going to prove in a moment. Now, my take is simple when it comes to this. I have black in my family. I have Asian in my family. And obviously, I have white in my family. I was born and raised in Panama as an American citizen. My whole Panamanian side is that beautiful caramel, that beautiful brown color. My Puerto Rican side, a good chunk of it is, there's a reason they call the Caribbean, a lot of it, Hispanic. From the background of Hispania, Spain. So my Puerto Rican side still has a lot of the Spaniard in them, along with some Indian, the Native American, African American, etc. That gene is the dominant gene from my mom. And my mom's dominant gene, even though her mother was called the N-word, the dominant gene that came out in my mother is the Asian gene from our Asian side in Panama. So we are truly mutts. So I grew up with brown and black, and then being in a military town, our whole neighborhood was brown, white, black, Asian. So I grew up with none of this racism. I never experienced it until I moved to the States when somebody called my grandmother the N-word, and I had to ask them, what's that mean? I had no clue. Then I started noticing, wow, it's not when my friends who were black, they'd be complaining and derogatorily talking about whites. And in that era, when growing up, whites would do the same towards blacks. So I heard it from both sides. I heard it from both sides. So I look at all this wokeness, this hatred, this homophily taken to racist extremes. I don't take that lightly. So I call out racism wherever it's at. And people who say, Well, minorities can't be racist. No, just because a government says that doesn't make it true. If that's true, then everything the government said regarding the Dred Scott decision is correct. And it's not. Hate begets hate. Hate is something that is taught. So there is racism in every culture because it's racism is hate, and that is taught. So back to Kotaku. They prioritize diversity over gaming expertise in this hire. Why? There was somebody who showed their resume. Phenomenal. More than qualified for this job better qualifications than this guy, Austin Williams. But he wasn't the right demographic. So they ignored him. Quote, Kotaku has always led with a distinct voice and point of view, while also understanding that at its core, it is fan first, unquote. That is what Austin Williams said. So he's pumping them up. And that's what he's publicly saying regarding his hire. But that's not true. The gaming community and ex-staff were concerned and are concerned about the site's current direction of being woke and looking at culture and color before gaming in every form. So obviously, his appointment has been surrounded by significant controversy, controversial statements. In 2016, here we go. I'm in an office full of white people today. Pray for me. In 2018, where's it at? Working with white people as a top five emotionally draining experience. In 2019, he stated that white people really are the rudest MFers on the planet. Don't believe me? Check it out for yourself. Racism is racism. And that is racism. I'm in an office full of white people today. Pray for me. Now imagine if a white man said, I'm in an office full of black people today. Pray for me. That guy would be run out of Dodge, and deservedly so. So why isn't Austin Williams? Because we're allowing racism in minority cultures, and all that's doing is, as Thomas Sowell said it would, is create hate amongst all cultures. Hate begets hate. White people are going to look at that and go, Latinos are going to look at that and go, Asians are going to look at that and go, anybody who's not black is going to look at that and go, that's racist. Why does he get away with it? And that's going to create more hate, because they're going to be wondering, why are they hiring and allowing a racist to keep working there when everybody else would rightfully so be bleep canned? And the other one, working with white people, definitely a top five emotionally draining experience. Again, picture if somebody else from a different culture would have said that. And finally, white people really are the rudest MFers on the planet. Now, I got to give credit here to the JT Smash Mouth. Follow him on Twitter, or rather X if you can. I saw this, or somebody sent it to me, but I believe they got it from him. Thinking about how, and they sent it to me because I am half Puerto Ricano, thinking about how unnerving it is for black folks to be around friendly Trump voters. My parents' next door neighbor is a Make America Great Again guy. He's also an overwhelmingly nice Puerto Rican man. So is their dentist, who pals around with him about 60s soul music. It's true. Get out, shit. He's being derogatory here. He doesn't like the fact that some of us are Make America Great Again supporters. And for the record, to my black friends out there, to my black relatives, to my brown friends, brown relatives who don't like Trump, when he says Make America Great Again, he's talking about the economic boom this country had after World War II. That's what Trump was always talking about. But it was the media who made it racist. And y'all know that. But y'all hate him so much, you allow your TDS to go along with the lie. So what I'm saying is, yes, you guys are the bigots in this case, not us. We're talking about the economic boom we want for everybody. And sure enough, he was making America great again. For blacks, Latinos, and Asians, when Trump was president, we did not have a bigger or better economy in our history. He did more for historically black college universities in giving them long-term funding than any other president had. His First Step program did not just help blacks, but helped anybody who'd been who was sitting in jail for minor offenses that they should not have been sitting in jail for. For example, many marijuana laws, because marijuana is not becoming legal. He also had a program set in place. I think they did away with it. The Biden administration did, where it was they were helping minority communities. So this guy may hate Trump, but he hates Trump because he's being ignorantly, purposely, or naively. Or actually, being ignorant means naive, meaning he doesn't realize he's being hateful for the wrong reasons. No, he knows. He knows. He knows. Everybody knows at this point. So these statements have been seen as making huge, sweeping generalizations about an entire race. And that's racism. It's offensive. And he's in a leadership position promoting hate now. Well, he got tired of the backlash that he deserved to get. So now he put his whole account on protected mode. So only his hateful friends, his bigoted friends, will see those. Now, some people might go, what's a big deal, William? I get it. You know, there's a saying that at least we Latinos have used. I've heard a lot of Latinos. Dude, that's a first world problem. Meaning here in America, we make up problems or we create problems versus third world nations where they're struggling to feed the family and make a buck. Or my friend who's black that I grew up with, he laughs at me and goes, white people be stupid. He's saying it as a joke. It's kind of like a running joke with us. We get it. But Austin Williams is not saying that as a joke. And we all know that and he knows that. So why do some consider him a DEI hire? Well, he has no gaming expertise. He's written two articles on gaming way back in 2018. And he's supposedly leading a gaming news site. The issue is Kotaku, which is what they've done for years now, is they prioritize diversity over gaming experience. They practice racism by not hiring the most qualified person. And in this case, there was a guy on YouTube showed his resume. Turned out he's white. They didn't hire him. My business would have gone under. Instead of being seen as one of the premier fantasy sports sites in the world before I sold it, my company had every player news contract. I think RotoWorld or RotoWire now, they're called. Now they control the industry in terms of player news contracts. We owned them. You know, Fox News, Yahoo, My Fantasy League, every service out there, we owned it when it came to player news. We were the NFL Network's first fantasy news analyst. My mouth got us in trouble, so that ended. But they were using us, and I did not appreciate how they were using us, you know. But had I hired people based off of color, man, we would not have gotten any of those contracts. The beat reporters we had in every locker room, they were black, brown, and white. Oh, and yellow, I guess, technically, the Asian. We had blacks, whites, Latinos, and Asians. I didn't care. I wanted a reporter representing that team in every locker room, and we got that. Some cases, we didn't have an option. It was a white guy. In Atlanta, the predominant reporters at the time were three or four black individuals. Well, there were a couple white, but we approached the black ones first, not because they were black, but because they were more well-known, and they had greater access. They had great relations with the players and coaches. They took the job. They had no money. They had no problem taking my money. So we didn't care. I practiced the best and most qualified individual over skin color. And that in turn gave us, again, white, Latino, black, and Asian. Now, I'll be honest. I think we only had like one or two Asians throughout the 10 years there. But my point is we did not put anything but the most qualified first and above all. And we had a very diverse beat reporter field. Again, he's anti-Trump, typical of a progressives. He's very extreme with his progressivism, as I just showed you. He's just a flat-out racist. And some people, they're worried about the potential influence on Kotaku's content. Now, don't worry about that. Kotaku has been hardcore left for years now. Now they're gonna continue their social activism, and I think it's a loss that companies losing money, which is why they want to go to gaming guides. There's money to be made in gaming guides, to my understanding. I don't know how, as you get a lot of fans who do free guides out there. So that shows me it's Kotaku's at a desperation point now, where they want to shift from their progressive wokeness to making gaming guides. They don't even want to really cover gaming news as much anymore, as they want to focus on the gaming guides. Yeah. Now, again, a lot of people say this is DEI because his appointment was seen by GO Media as, quote, a milestone moment in the brand's 20-year history, unquote. Highlighting that as Kotaku's first African-American editor-in-chief. Well, at the end of the day, he's an unqualified editor-in-chief, not because he's African-American, but because he's a music background, not a gaming background. Now, if they hired him because he's African-American, then that's a racist hire. Now, again, Complex Networks, BuzzFeed, Black Entertainment Digital, and Vibe Magazine, they're all tribalistic. They're all identity-focused media groups. Identity politics, in other words. Again, lack of a gaming background, primarily music and academia. And I'm just repeating myself here. GO Media. So most companies a year ago would have been probably saying, yeah, it's a DEI hire. You know, DEI, DEI, DEI. Okay. I had to think on it. I lied. I had to look it up. DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. So a lot of companies were saying that they were probably saying it's a DEI hire. It's a DEI hire. Why? Because it is diversity, equity, and inclusion. They're not saying that now because when you hear the term DEI, it's seen as demeaning because you hired them because of their culture or skin color. It's that simple. And it's not just Black Americans. It's Latino. Yo soy Latino. You know, when I first got involved in politics with the Republican Party, they loved me. I hit the check marks. I was Latino. They wanted more Latinos in the party. They didn't like my mouth because I would call them out. You know, in fact, I would call them out. Why are you guys running with a rich white guy when it's a Latino district? Why not look for a charismatic conservative Latino activist? No, they weren't going with a white guy because he's white. They were going with a guy with the most money, or the gal with the most money. That's what the Republican cared about more at the time. So when I would bring these things like that up, I wasn't very popular. So Kotaku's mission, despite this hire, they say, we have our mission. That is to be inclusive for all, for gamers of all backgrounds, including various ethnicities, genders, and sexual orientations. We're going to provide news, opinion pieces, and coverage of topics that serious gamers care about, including gaming, anime, TVs, and movies. It's the first part there. That is the DEI part. So even though they're like, no, this isn't DEI, their whole motto is about focusing on DEI in gaming and shoving it down our throats. Now, I will defend Austin Williams in this aspect, in this perspective. Sorry, people. I had my phone on. It's not how you get in, but what you do with it. So if he gets in there and turns it around, does a great job, gets the gaming guys going, starts to make money, God bless him. It doesn't matter how you get in. I had a friend of mine who was a SEAL, who was retiring, went to law school. His friend got him into a law firm, a small law firm. Well, he's all concerned about how he got in. And I told him, look, it's not how you get in. It's what you do with it. If you don't do anything with it, then yeah, he got you in and you shouldn't have gotten in. So we're going to wait and see what Austin Williams does with it. And then I will revisit this a few months from now, maybe half a year from now. So most people in this gaming industry or the gaming community believe that Austin Williams will continue the bigotry and hate toward gamers who want great games and not have DEI and wokeness shoved down their throats. Man, I hear something. House. What's that saying? The house noises that a house makes. So Austin Williams isn't qualified for the job, and GO ignored more qualified individuals with strong gaming backgrounds. They went with DEI in the negative sense, not in the positive sense here. That's my take. My final question to Kotaku and anybody who wants to argue with me. If this had been said by a white man, his tweets, his posts, it would be considered racist because it's bigotry and racism generalizing the whole race. And that's what Austin Williams did. Prove me wrong. You really can't. I'm being rhetorical. But come on, if you want, give it a shot. My take is we have to end racism across all cultures, colors, and religions. Bigotry, racism, it's hate. We have to end the hatred. Now, I want to thank Smash, JT, Atreus, and Kung Fu Hot Dog, as I did listen to some of their podcasts, not all of it, just to make sure I didn't miss anything about this. So, my final take on this is Austin Williams, the ball is in your court. What you do with it will determine how you are seen and the legacy you leave. Is it a DEI hire in the negative sense? Or is it, it doesn't matter how you get your foot in the door as long as you do something with it hire? Time will tell. All right, moving on, my friends. Pull up my notes, make sure they're correct, where I want to go. So we have our final segment here, where wokeness meets wallet woes. Thanks, Sweet Baby Inc., for turning blockbusters into financial busts. Now, let me also add in, it's a great, I love my titles. They're witty. But it's not about it being woke. That was just part of the overall issue here, and we're going to get into that. But the Alan Wake 2 controversy. It was released in October 27th, 2023, so almost a year ago. We're in August, a couple months away. It received critical acclaim, but it struggled to turn a profit. And it sold over 1.3 million copies by February. So in 5 months, over a million copies. But the game has not recouped its development and marketing costs. So let's check out the actual trailer to it before it came out. I did play the first game, and I think there was an add-on to it, if I remember correctly. This was years ago, and I enjoyed it. It was a simple little game done by Remedy. And Remedy is known more for the Max Payne franchises than anything else. And that was a nice little simple game with a great underlying story that could be expanded if it had more money. Alan Wake 2 came out, and people had high expectations, and it seems to have delivered. So this was a trailer. It's delivered in the sense of the what people wanted in the game. So here's a trailer, though, before it came out.
Peggy 18.
In a horror story, they're only victims and monsters. And the trick is not to end up as either.
Great graphic. Great graphic.
By the genre, we're all ripped to pieces along the way.
No! Welcome. We have a great show for you here tonight. Alan Wake, one of my all-time favorite writers, and this on the show.
He's here to talk about his latest book.
Man, they can make human beings look so
Initiation
real.
Tells the story of a fictional writer named Alan Wake, who is trapped in a nightmare, desperately trying to find the manuscript of a novel he has forgotten he has written.
This is Did you write these pages, Mr. Wake?
I'm trying to remember it.
You're the killer. The cult leader.
No! You've got the wrong man! It's my fault! He got out!
Wake Great has trailer. A double.
Great trailer.
Where is he now?
Ooh, love that cover.
Oh, yeah. Be in the story. Just write me out of the story.
Write me out of the story. I haven't played it yet. I will play it. I'm one of these guys. I wait for games to go cheap. I think State of Decay is the one franchise I will buy right away. I blogged thousands of hours in that game since 2018, and I play at its highest level. I'm what you call a geriatric gamer. I don't have much time, so I play an hour here or there. It's my release. But Alan Wake, I did enjoy the first one. You know, so for the audience out there, you know, well, actually, I always like presenting the pictures. Alan Wake has some pretty good, some pretty cool logos as well. As you can tell, it's a creepy nightmare type mode. I mean, it looks like a great game. The graphics, you know, we're at a point in games where it's like Hollywood. There was a time when the CGI, the graphics, you just had to buy the game regardless or go see the movie regardless. But now you got to have a good storyline with it. And Alan Wake is no different. And obviously it's a storyline that has millions. So we're going to get to this in a second. But there you go. So, again, released in October, late October 2023. Sold over 1.3 million copies by February. I'd imagine it's probably close to, easily probably past 1.5 million, 1.78 million. Yeah, I don't know, but it's still doing well by the standards that have been set upon it. It's a third-person survival horror game with investigative and puzzle-solving elements. You know, I guess it's not like Silent Hill 2, which scared the bejesus out of me at 2 in the morning back in the day, or Halo's The Library. going in there, battling that out, you're just overwhelmed with the flood. So there's a new protagonist, Sega Anderson, alongside Alan Wake. The narrative involves a complex self-referential story. Self-referential, he's in his own storyline about a dark presence and its influence on reality through fiction. Combat involves using light sources to dispel darkness. Darkness hates light, you know, shooting enemies before using conventional weapons. That's what I remember from the first game, too. Again, it's an investigative type game with puzzle solving elements. So it's a combination adventure with aspects of combat. And for us old worlders, we get that. Think King's Quest. There wasn't a lot of combat. There was no combat until the final King's Quest, actually. So an adventure and puzzle solving. So Remedy Games has tied it into its own universe where their other big franchise is called Control. I don't know if it's that big, but, you know, so they try to tie those games together and create a storyline, you know, kind of get more people to buy both games. So the financial performance. So Remedy Entertainment reported significant operating losses with an operating profit margin of minus 70%, down 84.4% for the entire year. That's really insignificant, or that's significant. I may be reading that wrong. I should have looked at those notes better. When I don't know if I have the dash there as dash and separating it, or if it's minus, but it looks like it's minus 70% in quarter three, 2023, and 84.4% for the entire year. So it's a down year, but that's probably because the game came out in late October. So all that is development costs. It's probably what we're looking at. We're looking at all their development. In fact, I'm pretty sure that's probably it. All the costs to make the game came out in October. It only had a couple of months. So the numbers from that year are going to be down. It had a development budget of about $76 million, and it hasn't recovered that yet. Quarter two of 2024, its financial results were $11.25 million, so that's up 16%. H1 2024 revenue of $23 million, which is up 33%. In other words, once the game came out, the company started to generate money. So the operating losses have decreased compared to the previous year. And that's expected. The whole year spent creating the game and this year's in generating a profit. So it's recouped a lot of its development and marketing expenses, but it has not yet generated royalties for Remedy. So what are royalties? The royalties mentioned refer to profit that Remedy Entertainment will receive or is receiving from sales of Alan Wake 2 after the game has recouped its development and marketing costs. So in essence, all it is revenue. You have gross revenue and net revenue. Gross being how much the game has made. Net revenue is how much profit it's made after all the costs of making it are cleared. So it hasn't generated a net profit in essence. So the financial reports indicate that while Alan Wake 2 has recouped most of its development and marketing costs, it's not fully recovered those costs. I mean, repetitious. But in other words, it's still paying off what it costs to make. It will make money. Once the game fully recoup its costs, All additional revenue will be split with Remedy, sharing 50% of the profit with Epic Game Store, which is owned by EA. So factors can... Now, people are shocked, rather. Let me backtrack just one step, half a step here. People are shocked that it's not making money yet. Well, there's a few reasons for that. First, let's get into the woke segment of it. And it's only partially true. Sweet Baby is a consulting firm that kind of blackmails its way into working for you so you don't get negative media. I shouldn't say that. It doesn't blackmail its way, but companies are hiring them so their DEI, their wokeness, is covered. So they were involved in the game's development, focusing on character arc, voice, and sensitivity reading. And some sources claim that the games associated with Sweet Baby Inc. tend to underperform financially. And that's true in some cases, not in all cases. So they have a shoddy track record. So their influence led to narrative and character changes that alienated some fans. Look, when you start shoving woke down people's throats, they're not going to watch it. I'm like that with television or movies. I'm like, I'm not going to watch it if it's woke. I don't care. Even if it's a perception of woke, I'm moving on. There's enough books I can read. There's enough quality shows. Hell, I'll watch old shows I enjoyed, or it's been 10, 15 years since I've seen them, and go watch those again. So, again, the critics argue that the narrative and character changes prioritize diversity and inclusion over appealing to the fan base. Specifically, race swapping of character Saga Anderson sparked controversy. She's originally portrayed as a white Finnish by a white Finnish actress in early teasers, and she was replaced by a black actress. DEI, wokeness being shoved down. We don't mind any of that, but when you purposely do it and you take away from somebody's job, you fire somebody else to hire somebody else only because of color or culture is wrong when you fire a minority and replace them with a white person, but it's also wrong when you fire a white person, replace them with a minority. You want to go for what is already set or the most qualified. It's as simple as that. That pissed people off. People are now writing that out there. They don't want to support wokeness. And I don't blame them. Wokeness is built on hate. You know, that change sparked criticism on social media with Remedy being accused of going woke, or they wanted a higher ESG score, which is what some of these companies shoot for. An ESG score is the acceptability by the woke community. So they weren't going to swap out Alan Wake or Alex Casey. But if they could have, they would have. But then that would have destroyed any sales. You know, some fans argue that the race swap contradicts the character's established appearance. Yeah, I agree with that. It's part of a broader trend of race swapping characters. I mean, I'll eventually show it. There's a massive poster of nearly 100 characters that have been swapped from their original cultures to cultures of color. In some of those cases, nobody cared because it's a great storyline. In some of those cases, we do care because you're purposely doing it out of hate and bigotry. Now, the director lied, Kyle O'Reilly, saying, oh, it's not true. It's not true. It is true. Sweet Baby Inc.'s influence did trigger that swap. And again, that does create an influence, or that does influence certain people in a negative fashion. Now, Sweet Baby Inc.'s involvement had a role in this. Some of their games that wokeness and DEI has become predominant that has cost them Suicide Squad, Kill the Justice League, underperform. It's criticized for its writing, character treatment. It did not sell very well. Marvel's Avengers. $50 million loss for Square Enix. Sweet Baby Inc.'s involvement was said to be part of that. Forspoken. Lackluster sales and a challenging reception. Another Square Enix disappointment. Gotham Knights. We don't have exact financial figures, but the game is mentioned alongside other Sweet Baby Inc. underperforming titles they're associated with. Yeah. So, yeah, there is truth to that. But that's not all of it in terms. Look, Alan Wake 2 is more of a small game market release in a highly competitive launch window with other major titles. So it did have to compete. It's a digital only release early on. Now that was a killer, but I'll tell you in a second why that was the case. Development costs were higher than normal. When you have high development costs, it got to sell much more. The break even. There was no Steam release. This is only available on Epic Game Store, which restricts its audience and sales potential. And the exclusivity limits the visibility, and it helps prevent some players from accessing the game due to other forms of restrictions. Maybe Epic isn't allowed in other countries, et cetera, et cetera. Steam is a big daddy of them all, but Steam has, they don't technically have a monopoly, but it may as well be a monopoly. It's kind of like Amazon.com, you know? So the exclusivity was an Epic. They're not going to sell as much on Epic because Steam dominates the market, but the reason you have the exclusivity is to get people who aren't aware or have not signed up for Steam to become part of, I'm sorry, for Epic Games and their storefront is for them to join and sign up. Thus, this is seen as a cost leader for Epic, meaning they put money into it. That money was used by Remedy to help create the game and new content that has just been released for it and new content that will be released. So they were using money from Epic. Epic helped fund this. Epic and Remedy knew what was happening. You get these ignorant, and I say ignorant because they're not stupid. They're just naive. They're ignorant. Well, they should have done this, should have done that. You don't know jack squat about how a business is run or how exclusivity works, but you're dictating why it failed and what they should have done. No, you moron. Maybe learn how to wipe your butt before you tell a business how to run its business when you've never done anything but flip burgers at McDonald's or you're living in mama's basement. And I do mean that in a derogatory way I said it. I had to deal with it with my own business. Like, bro, you don't know about this, this, and this in terms of running a business. You're judging it based off your little world that you work in. Those articles that you write. My business is more than just those articles you write. The business of gaming is not just you playing the game. There's a lot to get that game into your hands to play it and to grow the business. It's like, my God. Yeah. So there are a lot of factors with why it was on Epic, how Epic helped fund the game, and why sales will eventually pick back up and this will make money, especially if and when it goes to Steam. You know, that has a bigger influence than I think the DEI portion of it. I think the DEI portion of this lost a few gamers, but not many. You know, now they seem to be in desperation mode, though, Remedy does, because they have used bots. And where's it at? These images here. And bots are an unethical form of pushing or promoting anything. Bots are used in every aspect in every industry. And you can clearly see the bot use here. Finally, now my potato PC. Now I don't have to sell my kidney to play. Or finally, I don't want to have to sell my kidney to play. Great news. I can dust off my old PC. Finally, my potato PC can handle. You see the repetition under various accounts. They're bots. They're not real people. There's this fake account, and it's common, you know. So that's getting, they're getting hammered for that. Look at that. This bot, after thousands of bots were probably used. And I want to give credit to the bot use ex-post. Credit to @masterofthetds. You can find him on X. Want to give proper credit to that. You know, there's also, they've also reduced the PC requirements, which I think is a good thing, you know, but if the game was selling well enough, they wouldn't be lowering and making changes to the game in the graphics quality. And they're using the bots to really promote that. And, you know, it's a form of marketing. Some people may disagree with me and say, no, William, in this case, I can see that, but don't use bots. Just have a marketing campaign. Yeah. So what's the future outlook? Remedy remains optimistic. The launcher says, I do too. It's going to make its money, going to make money back. Their first DLC expansion, which Epic helped fund, Night Springs, has been released. A second pack named the Lake House is planned. They're also going to release, this was only a digital release available through the Epic Game Store. They are going to have a physical game, and that will help generate sales to old farts like me who don't, I don't have my Xbox. My last gaming console was Xbox 360. I play strictly now on PC now. But there's a lot of people with consoles only. They're not subscribing to any of these services. And they'll go out and they'll buy this game, the physical CD. And it's almost there in recouping its loss. You know, the Remedy just acquired the full rights to the Control franchise. So that money will be made, meaning those losses will... Alan Wake will help offset, and they're eventually going to be a company that's in the black. Max Payne 1 and 2, they are remaking those. I can't wait for that, or bringing them up to speed in terms of today's graphics. And they're going to have a more significant role in growing the Alan Wake and Control franchises and commercialization, marketing, and publishing. Right now, they have contractual obligations with Epic they have to deal with, you know? The game has received critical acclaim. It has a Metacritic score of 89. It's been praised for its rich intertwined. This is my writing hat. Its rich intertwining narrative and genuinely terrifying moments. Yeah. Now, a game like this has never been known for its combat. I hated the combat in the first game and the downloadable contact or the part two they made of that. I can't remember, so long ago. But so it does have combat pitfalls still. But it has solid sales figures. You know, if they get rid of the Sweet Baby Ink component moving down, that'll be better too. And they're going to be able to leverage this into future sales. So Remedy's long-term financial success does not remain to be seen. It will make money and it will do well. So I have no concerns with this company and its future sales with Alan Wake and Max Payne. I'm not too sure about Control, but Control was supposedly a hit of sorts. So there you have it. We covered Alan Wake 2. That is not just DEI that hurt its sales. Its exclusivity with Epic has hurt its sales, but that was expected and is factored into. Kotaku with its negative DEI hire of a racist. He's a full-blown racist. I showed you the proof. Prove me wrong. Tell me in the notes why I'm in the comment section why I'm wrong. But legit, not just hate or you get blocked. It's that simple. I don't tolerate hate from anybody. And finally, the Acolyte and why that was doomed from the get-go. Don't forget, hit like and share. And you can check out previous Red, White, and Rude. I have a great Highlander reboot with Henry Cavill. I always keep saying Cavill, but Cavill. Henry Cavill is going to do the reboot. Check out that clip. Check out previous podcasts of the Red, White, and Rude at grumblingsmedia.com, as well as our social media platforms of YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, ePandora. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, my friends, I am William Del Pilar. This is the Red, White, and Rude. I bid you adieu.